The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Okay, is FBI Director James Comey trying to be a kingmaker in the 2016 election? Or is he just trying to wave the flag of honest public servant in the disclosure of the FBI's search through some 650,000 emails sent to and from Clinton aide Huma Abedin, found on her estranged husband Anthony Weiner's laptop? You can't make this stuff up. It's unclear whether the review will produce any results before Election Day next Tuesday, and Comey stressed that. The FBI says they are using a top-flight computer program to expedite the process. Nonetheless, you reap what you sow, even if you didn't intend it in an election campaign. And FBI Director James Comey is now seen as anything but the meek, mild FBI director of a few months ago. Did he really not think he would have the impact he's now having? Donald Ayer thinks Comey made a huge, possibly indefensible blunder here, a mistake that crosses the line forbidding public servants from interfering in an election campaign. Ayer is a former senior Justice Department official who has crossed party lines to criticize Comey along with others. He served as Deputy Attorney General between 1989 and 1990 under President George H.W. Bush, and he joins me now. Donald Ayer, welcome to The Takeaway.
Glad to be here.
So what is FBI Director Comey trying to do? Cover himself? It seemed as though he wasn't entirely satisfied with his report to Congress in the sort of last sign-off on the email investigation some months ago.
What I think is interesting is to think back to the statement he made back in July when, you know, Hillary Clinton supporters held their breath and were relieved and pleased that he decided not to, the evidence didn't support a prosecution, and he made that utterly clear. And then, somewhat not to their liking, he went on and on and on about various aspects of things he'd found, poor judgment and various things that were not at all to their liking, but on balance, we'll take it, right? Because better not to be indicted. And I think that got him into a situation where he had decided to do something quite improper. And I didn't think of it at the time either, I have to say. But the idea that a prosecutor in our system, or one charged with a decision-making role there to decide to prosecute or not, would, when deciding not to prosecute, then go on at length about evidence that was less than complimentary to the person investigated. In an ordinary case, we'd all be appalled. And the power that that would put in the hands of government officials to tar the reputations of anybody would be enormous. Yet it happened here, and we all sat and listened and thought it was fine. Well, I think he had become the commentator-in-chief, in a sense, on this most important of all immediate issues. And so when a few, whatever it is that straggled in, and we don't really know what it was, but when a bunch of emails, which may all be repetitive and maybe nothing at all of any consequence, when they straggled in, he needed to keep commentating. And I guess the focus of that is apparently he felt strongly he'd said things to folks on the Hill that meant for his sort of integrity and honesty, he needed to update. The key point is he had no business whatsoever doing commentary on an investigation, either as it's ongoing or after decisions made to not prosecute, to talk about the bad stuff they found.
But Donald Ayer, isn't it a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of a situation, in that once someone gets elected and there's the disclosure that there is, in fact, another FBI investigation going on that wasn't disclosed before the election, doesn't the exact same charge come down the pipe?
Well, I think there are burdens that come with being a government official who has to make these decisions. And if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. The prosecutor who makes a decision not to prosecute a mob boss or makes a decision not to prosecute a drug dealer because they don't have evidence, whatever the decision, it can always be second-guessed. And if it's high enough profile, sure, you can end up looking bad. And maybe you can end up looking bad no matter what you do. But you know what? That goes with the job. And one of the things about Jim Comey is he's had an extraordinary career of enormous successes and exaltation, really. And I think he deserves a lot of it. I think he's done a lot of good things, and I think you have to compliment what he's done. But none of that justifies taking the job he had to do here, which fell to him here for some peculiar reasons, to decide whether to prosecute and turn it into a running commentary on Hillary Clinton and or the investigation as it may or may not be rejuvenated later.
Is it the case that we always presume the worst whenever the FBI opens its mouth, and that it is a cynical view that the FBI, looking at anything, always is suspicious and casts aspersions on the target of that investigation?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't know where one would get that idea.
All right, then if that's the case, Comey can open his mouth and say, quite literally, we're just looking at some stuff. We have no idea if there's anything bad, and can sleep good at night knowing that he hasn't tried to influence the election.
Well, two things about it. One is that at this time in the election, 11 days before the election, it's hard to imagine words that would suffice to set off no alarms and cause no one to misunderstand when you essentially say, not in these words, but the message is we're reopening our investigation. So I question whether that's ever possible. But even if it's possible, the letter he wrote didn't do that. And frankly, I think what he ought to do now, if he wakes up to the fact that he's made a dreadful blunder, is he ought to put out words that try to do that. The letter said that they'd found material that appears to be pertinent to the investigation. Well, pertinent's a fuzzy word, and you can attach various meanings to it. Pertinent can mean, well, gosh, it's stuff that's somehow related to Hillary Clinton. It's some sort of email. Or pertinent can mean it actually has some logical bearing, i.e., it's something other than what we've already seen. Who knows what it means, And he did say later on, but it's buried in the bottom of the letter, that they didn't know if the information was, quote, significant. What he needs to do now is make a mea culpa statement acknowledging he's made a terrible mistake. He never should have been out there talking about this stuff. He never should have sent the letter. But now that it's out there, let me tell you, we don't have any information and no awareness at this point that there is anything that might change the outcome of that decision.
Donald Ayer served as Deputy Attorney General under President George H.W. Bush between 1989 and 90. And was also a U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of California, appointed by President Reagan. Here's a suggestion. Wisconsin may be the place to go to get away from Trump-Clinton fatigue. First of all, it's a rematch of the 2010 Senate contest going on statewide. Republican Ron Johnson is running against Democrat Russ Feingold. And while you may recognize the name of Feingold because he's the liberal veteran in Wisconsin politics, Johnson is actually the incumbent. You'll recall he swooped into office on the Tea Party wave that helped Republicans take the Senate 6 years ago. Sean Johnson is Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome to The Takeaway, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
So it wasn't really a close race in 2010, but this looks like a photo finish. Why?
It does, and I'm not entirely sure. I think going into this race, even though Johnson was the incumbent, as you mentioned, this is a seat that Democrats really expected to win. It's a different cycle. It's not the Tea Party wave of 2010. It's a presidential election, and there's much higher turnout in Wisconsin especially, and that always helps Democrats here. And you have Russ Feingold on the ballot against Ron Johnson and Ron Johnson, who has his own record now. So I think going in, Democrats felt like this was going to be easy. Actually, if you look at all the polling in the race, Feingold has led consistently, but it seems like it's really close here at this late stage in the race, especially with all the money starting to pour in from both sides.
Did Johnson fail to raise his own profile? Wisconsin is a state of very, very famous senators.
Yeah, if you look at Johnson's profile in Wisconsin in terms of the number of Wisconsinites who have an opinion about him, it's pretty low, actually. Russ Feingold, more people have an opinion about Russ Feingold one way or the other than have an opinion about Ron Johnson. Even Tammy Baldwin, the state's junior senator who was elected in 2012, is more well known at this point, even during campaign season, than Ron Johnson. So that is something that he hasn't been able to crack. He is trying to introduce himself to voters here in the last week.
And he's not been a part of any of the big, high profile investigations for good or ill. I mean, Benghazi that was in the House, but still, the Wells Fargo investigation. I mean, he's just not the person that holds a news conference to get a soundbite out into the circulation. And it seems curious to me because he's an insurgent Tea Party guy.
He's been involved in those issues. I wouldn't say he's been the front person on them necessarily. You know, on Benghazi, I think Senator Johnson would say, I've been very involved in that. There's a kind of a somewhat famous passage back and forth between him and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton when she testified on Benghazi, where she basically cut him off in his questioning, and that gets played back, you know, to this day. But was that his investigation? It wasn't. He's there. He's out there talking about these issues, but he's not necessarily the front person.
What's the outside money issue? You referred to it before.
Yeah. So I think early on in this race, what you saw is that Russ Feingold and Russ Feingold's campaign was actually outraising Ron Johnson and Ron Johnson's campaign. And the polling was good enough for Russ Feingold that you actually saw outside Democratic groups who were here decide they want to go put their money in other states and maybe expand the map. In the interim, what you've seen is that Johnson's fundraising has picked up a little bit, but beyond that, you've had a lot of third-party money coming in for Republicans, a lot of interest groups, PACs, who are spending money big here. They see it as a chance for an unlikely hold in this unlikely election year.
Finally, Feingold is an interesting character. You would associate him with Bernie Sanders, not Hillary Clinton necessarily. I'm wondering if that makes him immune from both the downside of Trump and of Hillary Clinton in this election.
I think if you look at his record, he is more along the lines of a Bernie Sanders Democrat. But this year, he's really tried to walk that line. I mean, this is a state that supported Bernie Sanders in the primary, and so he wants those voters to come along to him. He has a friendship with Bernie Sanders. Sanders has campaigned for Russ Feingold, but he doesn't want to turn off those Hillary Clinton supporters. He has supported her when asked point blank, do you find her trustworthy? Do you stand with her in light of, statement from the FBI on these emails? And he's stood with Hillary Clinton all the way. He's kind of trying to have it both ways this time. He's not out there taking hugely controversial stands that are out of step with the Democratic Party in any way.
Looks like it may be working for him. Sean Johnson, Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You may have felt all the warmth as Canada expressed its sympathy to all of us about the 2016 election when we focused on our northern neighbor this week. But it's real tangible alarm south of the border in Mexico, which is the U.S.'s third largest trading partner after Canada and China. Mexicans have been sacrificial lambs on issues of trade and immigration throughout this campaign. But how are ordinary Mexicans viewing this election from their side of the border? To answer that, we turn to Monica Campbell in Mexico City. She's editor of the Global Nation Desk for our partner, PRI's The World.
People are extremely nervous that Trump has a chance at winning. Clinton, there's no comparison. She's much more popular. People are critical of the fact that she supported the war in Iraq. There are strong critics of NAFTA here, but there's no comparison that a Clinton presidency is much better for Mexico than a Trump presidency. And we've even seen it with the rise and fall of the peso, the local currency here. Trump rises in the polls, the peso here weakens. So if there's any indication, you can just follow that.
I'm curious about this fellow that you spoke with, Robert Bibar, who's 59 years old. You managed to speak with him in Tijuana. He expresses this seriousness about what the importance is of this election.
The outcome of the election will shape not only my future, but the future of many moms and families. If the correct candidate, the correct congressmen, senators are able to win their districts, there would be politicians that would actually work for a just, humane immigration reform.
He sounds worried.
He is. Mexico is has a huge investment in the U.S. election. You can't meet a Mexican here in this country who doesn't have family in the United States. And this gentleman, Robert Bibar, is one of those people. He has a U.S.-born daughter. He lived in the United States for years. He was deported. And he's hoping that the next president can enact real immigration reform, and particularly what President Obama has been trying to enact, which is a executive action that would give people like Robert Bivar a chance at legal status in the United States because they have U.S. born children.
Some of the other voices you spoke with, you get the sense that while it's talked about as a fairness issue in the United States, immigration reform, it's a human rights issue among Mexicans.
Yes, absolutely. I spoke with a woman. Her name is Maria Garcia. She lived in Chicago for 15 years. She was undocumented, worked at a factory there. She now lives in Mexico City. And she also hopes that the U.S. election will make immigration reform possible. She sees immigration reform as something that treats people humanely and that it would be a reform that would recognize the binational aspect of many Mexicans.
Una regulación migratoria real.
True and humane immigration reform. That's also viable because we are binational. We have family in Mexico. We have family in the United States. This duality that Mexicans abroad have should be recognized.
Maria makes the point that from the Mexicans' perspective, the border needs to be blurred between the United States and Mexico, not turned into a walled-in clear line on a map. As Donald Trump and some others are talking about, it's a radical difference in points of view.
Absolutely, because people here in Mexico, and so many people have lived in the United States or have relatives who live in the United States, know that what they do in the U.S. is valuable and that their decisions to leave their country and go to the United States and work and live is an important decision that nobody takes lightly, and that this type of human aspect of migration should be recognized. And then also, of course, just the plain practical aspect that Mexicans, many Mexicans in the United States are doing incredibly hard and valuable work, that that should be recognized instead of building a taller wall and to keep these two countries that have such shared vested interests apart. And that's something that Mexicans here see very clearly. And they look at somebody like Donald Trump and think, he doesn't know our lives. He doesn't know what we do. And gosh, you know, we really wish that there would be a different discourse happening when it comes to immigration than this very polarizing debate that we're seeing centered around a border wall.
Of course, we know that both candidates, Monica, have spoken about border security. And I'm wondering, as Mexicans look north to the choice in the November election, do they worry about that border security talk increasing the likelihood of unrest in Mexico itself? Or is it more a matter of Mexicans looking to the north and going, there they go again?
I think it's more that they're looking at the United States and hearing some of the same debate and rhetoric that's been heard for years when it comes to talking about immigration. You know, what do we do at the southern border, instead of really speaking about the real issues at play, which are the demand for labor, the fact that these are two neighboring countries, the fact that Mexico still is one of America's largest trading partners and vice versa. At the same time, I think one of the issues that's going to be increasingly difficult for the next president will be also the flow of migrants through Mexico, particularly from Central America. That's something that's real. And I think how the next president deals with that increasing flow of refugees or migrants, however you want to term them, that's a real issue.
Monica Campbell is editor of the Global Nation Desk for PRI's The World, based in Mexico City. Monica, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
We are going to focus on many of the issues that voters tell us are most important. Jobs.
Law and order.
Climate change.
Social security.
This next question comes from the public.
The biggest tax cuts.
Your schools are no good.
Immigration.
How can you unite a country?
Income inequality.
You have no jobs.
Gross national debt.
Pre-existing conditions.
Race.
You're living in poverty.
Uncertain issues.
Too much inequality.
Cyber attack.
Deportation.
The Supreme Court.
Discipline.
Let me repeat the question.
Woo! Okay.
So, let's begin.
It's a challenge every election cycle. How do you slice up the American electorate into groups that have meaning if you look at specific issues? Is there a way to really see how issues affect Americans in different communities? Answering this question is the mission of the American Communities Project that has divided the country into 15 distinct communities. Using these categories as a guide and a little of our own reporting, we've been pursuing an initiative we're calling Portrait of an American Voter. We're hearing your thoughts and concerns about the challenges facing our nation. It's not a scientific poll. It's more a personal, emotional exploration of how individual voters are making up their minds on issues from education and the environment to police brutality and PTSD. Up next, we hear from a voter in the Hispanic Centers community type.
My name is Christina Garcia. I'm 33 years old. I live in El Paso, Texas. And I am an accredited representative and the Crime Victim Program Coordinator at Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center.
Definitely, I'm first generation U.S. citizen, so my parents were both immigrants. Living so close to Mexico and seeing that the textile industry definitely was something that a lot of family members that I know worked in, people now as an adult that I've been able to speak to either clients or people from school or from different professions have known somebody at one point in life that worked in the textile industries. When I was in high school, we started to see the effects of NAFTA, but through the Mexican side, right? So all these textile industries, most of them moved to Mexico for cheaper labor. We see the effects still because of NAFTA, right? So as a border, we're still seeing the bridges that are swamped with these big trailers that are crossing on a daily basis and swamping our highways and swamping our ports of entry, right? But we're not seeing a lot of those financial impacts in a positive way in the community, right? It's an interesting dynamic. One of the bigger issues that is going to affect our borders if the TPP gets passed. I think that that's definitely going to hit our community in a very impactful way. It's definitely going to affect our border sister city of Ciudad Juarez. And the sad part about that is some of our politicians are actually for TPP, so they're not fully representing their constituents, but they're mainly representing those that have business motives or agendas. I've chosen to stay in El Paso so that I can give back to my community and hopefully contribute to changing it in a better way too.
That's voter Christina Garcia from El Paso, Texas. To hear all 15 voices featured in our American Voter Project, head on over to thetakeaway.org/voter. Voters worry a lot about trade and trade agreements, and with the kind of rhetoric we've been hearing in the 2016 campaign, you would think that the majority of economic malaise in America comes from some bungled trade deal or another, or the fear of another rising global trading partner. In fact, it's quite difficult for any individual American to know how much his or her fortunes are tied to trade. A factory moving to Mexico and laying off all its workers is an easy link, but those kind of direct links are rare. The total value of American imports and exports fell by more than $200 billion last year, for instance. It's an unusual trend during a period of economic growth in America, but it's an almost indecipherable number when you try and relate it to a specific job or industry. Matt Slaughter is Dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth and Professor of International Business. Matt, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
How do we decode what's going on in the political rhetoric in the sense that Donald Trump talks a lot about jobs that should be returning? Hillary Clinton talks to some extent about wanting the same thing, but the Democrats emphasize the amount of exports that trade produces and direct investment into the United States. And then there's the whole issue of commodities. Can we determine what economic activity is most important to the voters in the aggregate trade figures?
Great question. I think what the typical American voter cares most about is not so much those aggregates, important and somewhat informative as they are. They care more about how they're doing. How's their job? How's their pocketbook looking? And a sense of opportunity. And I think the environment we find ourselves in now is one where both on the left and right in America and in a lot of other countries, people are very focused on the reality, which has long been the case, that greater trade and other forms of globalization don't directly benefit every single worker and company and community. And I think it's those distributional challenges, especially in the United States, that are really coming to the fore.
Is there an opportunity to renegotiate like NAFTA or to redesign the Trans-Pacific Partnership to be more slanted in favor of American workers? Or is it impossible to think about that except on a case-by-case basis?
It's really hard to think about renegotiating these trade treaties. The United States government invests literally several years, sometimes over a decade, to negotiate all the different clauses with the many other member countries. I think what is very possible, in fact, I think we need a lot more of, is a conversation in America about how to modernize, strengthen, and better fund our social safety net. Because the reality is there's a tremendous amount of dynamism in America's labor market, only part of which is linked to international trade. The majority of job destruction in the United States, all the academic studies show, come from other forces, such as ongoing technological change and innovation. So I think the reality needs to be, regardless of what's the source of any particular job dislocation, can we have a more modern, better funded, more responsive set of public policies that'll help all American workers through any kind of job transition?
Finally, with the stipulation that everyone is an expert on their own misery or excitement about the way things are going economically in their own life, how much of the rhetoric in the campaign, what percentage is economics and what percentage is just xenophobia?
Oof, great question. I think, unfortunately, a part of it is xenophobia. I think America has long had ambivalence towards what it means to be engaged with the rest of the world. That's because there's a lot of dimensions other than just the economics of national security and other factors. And yet today, the economics is a predominant consideration, I think. The reality is the typical American family today, their average income is lower than it was about 10 to 15 years ago. So finding a way that we can have pro-growth, pro-global connected policies to raise productivity growth and raise average incomes connected with a strong social safety net, that's hopefully what will come out of the election in the months ahead.
Trade will help with that goal, which is a great goal, or a trade is just a tiny piece of that goal?
Trade can definitely help, especially when other aspects of how the global economy isn't going all that great. When we have more agreements with the rest of the world, that raises average wages in America. And then the challenge, I think, is to have the right set of supporting policies in place so that more workers and more communities have a chance to benefit from those new opportunities.
Matt Slaughter is dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth and professor of international business at Dartmouth as well. Thanks so much, Matt.
My pleasure. Thank you, John.
What's your opinion on trade deals?
Hi, Hans Donkers of Monroe, Washington. Well-written trade pacts are beneficial, and 85% of job loss is from technology and not from outsourcing. When was the last time you went into a bank or had someone pump your gas?
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's our number. 40 years ago, the music, as that old fogey Don McLean might say, got louder. Punk refused its name and became the movement to send rock back to the fringe and get it away from pop celebrity. Hard to have much pop celebrity with a name like the Dead Kennedys, right, back in the 1980s. The Ramones screamed the anthems of Holy Mayhem from New York City, Husker Du from the Twin Cities, Sid Vicious had both celebrity and fringe. And then women voices of L7 and Hole grabbed the mic and the club scene shuffled again with different personnel. Punk has lost its underground rep as a genre, but the bands who play messages of angst and doom are alive and well in an underground world that never went away, and now has a higher profile because of the internet and a greater variety of messages. Katie Alice Greer is the frontwoman of the D.C.-based band Priests. You can scour the weeklies to find the next dive where they are playing, or just Google them. And she says that's how a lot of bands get discovered these days.
I think women have always been making some of the most interesting music, whether it's punk or anything else, same with people of color. And it's an interesting question of, like, whether or not punk is more inclusive right now. I think that, like, punk was built by women and people of color, queer people, people who are not the majority. And maybe now, with the internet, we're hearing more from those voices. But we've always been around doing things like that.
And it's not so much a hear-from impulse as it is a participatory impulse. I mean, punk is a way of joining a whole movement, even if you just go to a club once. If the message means something to you, there's a powerful experience there at the heart of punk, whatever the music is. How is that a truth in what you do, the fans that come to your concerts?
Nobody owns punk. Nobody owns the definition of the word. It probably means a million different things to a million different people. If some of that speaks to you at a show or speaks to you on a recording, you can take whatever you want from that and interpret those ideas in your own life. You don't need a membership card or any other permission from anybody.
How much does social media enlarge the community, enlarge the rave pit, if I can sound like an old white guy to bring that up?
There are systems at play that silence a lot of voices, and maybe with infrastructure that is built on social media, those voices are amplified. So it's like, oh wow, all these people have been here the whole time and have been doing all these things, and via social media, more voices can be a part of the conversation a lot of times.
Is punk more or less likely or more vulnerable to being dismissed by mainstream culture these days than in the past?
Punk has always been about resisting the mainstream, resisting oppressive infrastructures of capitalism, white supremacy, I think the things that kind of guide culture in the USA. Punk, on a very shallow level, has been very marketable. It's been very trendy. The mainstream really wants to embrace that. And I think a lot of people very justifiably involved in punk are interested in still finding ways to preserve the subversion of punk, the resistance of it, while still making it something vital and available to whoever wants it.
Let's explore what that means, because I think, on the one hand, people can value the idea that an institution like the Metropolitan Museum of Art would value the movement of punk and the historical significance of punk. But when you see punk clothing at a Gap, you know,
or even for me as someone who's working in a band, like, my profession is making music, so you start to really tread a fine line when people want to market my band as a punk band. There's going to be plenty of people in punk who are like, don't make your living off of being associated with punk. Questions like that, I think, actually make 2016 a really interesting idea for anyone involved in making countercultural or subversive art, whether you want to call it punk or anything else. Like, how do we resist? How do we make group conversations that lots of voices can be a part of without feeling like we're being gobbled up by the machine of the culture industry or capitalism?
How does punk or the band Priests liberate you to explain and celebrate your own experience as a young woman?
I've lived in D.C. for over a decade, but I grew up in the suburbs in Michigan. And punk for me was like something I discovered obsessively reading about music on the internet, and was like old bands that didn't exist anymore. I thought it was, you know, this long gone thing. And then I moved to a city and started going to shows and was like, oh my God, it's happening right now. And wow, this is so exciting. We'll be right back. I think punk is way less something that you can tell by ear. It's a lot more ideological or conceptual. All kinds of things could be punk.
One of the things I notice is that there is a sense, call me crazy, that you want people to hear the lyrics. Is that true?
There are things that I know people will, you hear it and you think, oh, that sounds like a punk band. For me, especially in this modern age where punk is such a commodity and it's so trendy, I don't really care if your band quote-unquote sounds punk. For me, the way you are producing your music, the way the ideas that you have in there, that is, for me, how I decide if something sounds punk or not. But for me, it's much more about, like, are you making something vital and necessary that is trying to fight this incredibly oppressive culture that's produced the psychotic election that we're all watching happen right now.
An album title, Psychotic Election? Possible?
Yeah, like I'm going to I'll write that down. Mm, yeah, definitely. Totally.
Katie Alice Greer, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
The band is Priests. Their album, Nothing Feels Natural, is out January 27th. Take this with you. Put the year 2056 on your calendar, but only if you're a white American woman worker. The Institute for Women's Policy Research says it will take that long for women's pay compared to men to equalize. But for African American women, 2124 is the year of equality. For Hispanic women, the wait is the longest, 232 years. The year of equality at that rate is 2248. That's the year for Hispanic women. The World Economic Forum doesn't do breakouts by race. Its study says achieving parity generally between women and men workers will take a depressing 170 years. Subscribe and download the Takeaway podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Be sure to fight about that statistic with your significant other. I would recommend it. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. Tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. Boy, that's depressing. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Everybody's moving. Everybody's moving.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.